Welcome to another edition of Expanding Mind. I'm your host, Eric Davis, exploring the cultures of consciousness. If you practice yoga and or modern postural yoga, to be specific, and you go into those weird shops that are kind of mixtures of health, spas and spiritual retreats and different sort of blends, you know, different studios do it in different ways, but there's that peculiar mixture of practical self-help and spiritual ambiance. And if you look at the books, as I invariably do, partly out of anthropology and partly because I'm an inveterate book scanner, you will, of course, come across the Yoga Sutras. And the Yoga Sutras function in the sort of modern yoga scene as the kind of the central scripture, the spiritual classic, as they say. It's sort of like, you know, like the Bible or the I Ching or the Bhagavad Gita, in terms of sort of locating a sense that there's some book that organized, some classic, some tradition that reaches far back into the past and that somehow organizes and grounds the modern yoga current. And though there are, though it's exceptionally rare that one finds intellectual courses in the context of modern postural yoga, when they occasionally appear, they almost always involve the Yoga Sutras. And luckily, today, we're going to sort of get a nice slice of the complex, I won't say true history of the Yoga Sutras, but at least the an opened up version of the tale that gives us an alternate perspective to this notion that there's a single book that organizes the yoga tradition continuously for, you know, 1500 years or back to the sages of the old days, and that its meanings are clear and accessible. And instead we find that it's even as far as spiritual classics go, a particularly layered, complex, and kind of arcane text, especially when considering the different ways that it has been interpreted over the years. And our guy today will be David Gordon White, professor at UC Santa Barbara, who we've had on the show before to talk about sinister yogis. And Professor White is an outstanding scholar of Hindu literature and Sanskrit literature. And his new book is called The Yoga Sutra of Patanjali, a biography. And it's part of a wonderful series of books put out by Princeton University Press, which is the Lives of Great Religious Books. And as a bibliophile who sort of is fascinated by religious books as a kind of category of literature, I really commend them on the series. There's always top-notch scholars writing about it. And I've read a number of books in a series, and it's pretty recommended. They have a nice blend of scholarship and a degree of accessibility that that makes them a fine blend. So I look forward to talking about it in a moment. But first, we'll bring on our co-host here on Expanding Mind, Maja Daou. Hi, Maja.
Hi. How's it going?
Pretty good. Pretty good. So, Have you read the Yoga Sutras?
I totally have. My first introduction to them was the book How to Know God, which, of course, is the Christopher Isherwood one. And I didn't even know what it was. I just liked the title. I was like, I want to know how to know God. So I picked it up and then read it. And then I was like, oh, it's the Yoga Sutras. And I always, with religious texts, I like ones with commentary. So I particularly enjoyed that version because it has, like, all the extra stuff in there. But then I read it, and it was like, it felt to me like a compilation. Like, when you finish reading it, you're like, well, where did they get all this stuff from, was like my question. It obviously reads like someone who's kind of accumulated the stuff and made like a Cliff's Notes. I feel like the Yoga Sutras read like a Cliff's Notes of like yoga literature. So that it, I tried to track it down and had little success in finding where it came from. So I'm so excited that Professor White did all this work, because it's real. Whenever you try to find where any religious text comes from, you either end up at snake people or aliens, and it kind of goes one of the two ways. So it's really an adventure to go on these treks of where this information comes from.
Yeah, yeah. No, it's funny. I also came across it first in that volume with Christopher Isherwood, which I really like as a sort of nice mid-century view of the pre-hippie moment of trying to bring yoga into the West. And I find Christopher Isherwood, who was a famous writer, a wonderful literary figure, but who also got very interested in Vedanta or Neo-Vedanta and in California. So it's got that kind of California twist, California
yeah.
being such an important part of the modern Western yoga story. Nice to remember that text. Let's turn to Professor White. Thanks so much for joining us here on Expanding Mind.
Oh, thanks for having me again.
That's great. You have many potential topics of things to write about. What was it that intrigued you about the Yoga Sutras? Were you partly interested in the text because of its popularity and almost ubiquity in the modern yoga world?
Well, I've sort of been arguing against the importance of the Yoga Sutras in my earlier writing, and without really addressing the text itself directly, so I thought I owed it to myself to do that, and that's when I began this archaeology of the Yoga Sutras and the way it's been read over the last, well, we don't know really, somewhere between 1600 and 2000 years.
Right. Well, could you give a sense, at least from your perspective, of how the book is generally received or presented, I should say, framed in the modern world before we turn to the more complex story of its origins? When you when you stumble across it in the different, there's a zillion translations that pop up in New Age bookshops and yoga stores. There's a sort of overall sense of its importance, of what it communicates. Could you give a shot at what that looks like from your perspective before presenting your very different tale?
Well, it, as you said in your introduction, the Yoga Sutra or Yoga Sutras, both are applicable, is generally presented as a Bible of yoga in all its forms, and that would generally mean the postural yoga that people practice today, as well as forms of meditation and so forth. And that one finds in yoga studios, yoga centers, yoga websites, yoga blogs, yoga books, all over the yoga subculture, which is extensive, of course. What is it, something like 17 million people practice yoga in the United States alone. And that generally to the exclusion of all other works on yoga or all other works that have discussions of yoga in them. So that's kind of been the lay of the land for the last 30, 40 years. And I think we can attribute much of that to, well, certainly going back to Swami Vivekananda, but I'm already going into history here, back around the turn of the 20th century, but even more recently, rewriting of the life and teachings and work of Krishnamacharya, the great innovator of postural yoga.
Well, let's go back, but before we start with the historical tale, I'd love to have you reflect a little bit, as you do in the book, on exactly what critical scholarship is and the difference between critical scholarship and the sorts of presentations, which may include history, that you often see in a more popular vein. Like, what is the some of the specific differences about the method or the angle of approach when you come from a perspective of critical scholarship to look at a book that is considered a religious classic, considered to be a powerful spiritual text?
Sure. You know, about 200 years ago, a German theologian named Schleiermacher suggested that perhaps the way that people were reading the Bible in the 19th century was not the same way as people understood it in the 1st century or the 2nd century or the 5th century, that there was historical distance, and with that distance there was changing cultural, literary, social, linguistic context, and that one had to take account of those changing contexts. So from that time forward, I mean, in a sense, he was taking his lead from the classicists who were studying, you know, Plato and Socrates and others, trying to understand these works in their own context to the extent possible. And since we can't go back in time to the days of Patanjali, the best one can do is to go back in time to those persons who were reading and writing about Patanjali as close to his time as is possible. So those, for scholars, are the earliest commentators. Commentators, people who wrote commentaries on texts, important scripture and important philosophical texts like the Yoga Sutras. And so there are a certain number of those. And those are the authors that scholars engage the most with. Those commentators give their readings of what the words, the individual terms in texts like the Yoga Sutras meant to them, maybe 3 centuries on, 5 centuries on, 10 centuries on, as opposed to where we are now. And you sort of triangulate from what these more contemporary readers of the Yoga Sutras considered its terminology to mean, back to what perhaps Patanjali actually meant when he compiled those sutras. So that's the main sort of angle that critical scholars take. They work through the very difficult Sanskrit commentaries, these sort of deconstructions or reconstructions of the original language by what were the greatest minds of their time, through the windows of those commentaries, try to glimpse the Yoga Sutras that lay behind those commentaries.
And it's so critical, just to add, for anyone who's ever had any religious or any text needing that kind of critical scholarship, like whether it's a Rashi commentary on the Hebrew Bible or Eric Red Pine's version of the Tao Te Ching, just a different critical analysis of those scholars can really make the difference between having a single idea of what the heck they're talking about and just being completely lost. In my experience, it's been the difference between feeling like I understood the material and then trying to find out how to apply a metaphor in some abstract way. So it's very, it's really an important thing to have those available.
It is. At the same time, they can be as opaque as the original text itself, and they often are.
Right.
So, you're kind of between a rock and a hard place quite often. But yes, certainly that's the case. And I mean, what is the alternative? Well, it's reading the Yoga Sutras through the lens of modern sensitivities and spirituality and sort of projecting 21st century notions of yoga and meditation and so forth back on a text that was written in a very different time and place. So critical scholarship attempts to kind of get back as close to the source as possible.
Yeah,
I don't know if this is the place. Go ahead, Eric. Yeah.
No, I was just thinking. I just popped in my head that one of the things that I think we find with the contemporary, spiritual movements and people who are seeking religious knowledge today, who are coming to these texts out of some personal need, out of some sense that they're special, that they have some kind of an extra perspective to give. There's a tendency to want, the real deal, the real McCoy, the pure source, the original, the first movement. When, if you look at most religious traditions that are more established and settled than something like, the contemporary yoga meditation world, that most people read or approach texts through layers of commentary. It's completely conventional to buy a classic that has spiritual contemporaries sort of shaping it, filtering it. And so there's a funny thing that you see just on the level of desire, of like wanting the Yoga Sutra to be a pure source and not being aware of the fact that any version of it you read, if you're just trying to read the text itself, quote unquote, or the inevitable commentary that frames it, you're always in this perspectival world. And in that sense, it's so I always encourage people to turn to critical scholarship, even if they're interested in these things, not in a purely scholarly way, because it enriches the experience and also raises some of these problems about how we do know and how we do try to authenticate some kind of tradition. So I know that's not exactly what you're doing as a scholar, but I think that there is something very more than academic about the work of understanding these layers of commentary. That's what I mean.
Well, yeah, you know, if you take a parallel example, the United States Constitution, and I refer to it in the book, there are the pure constitutionalists who feel like they can put their hand on the Constitution and understand exactly what the framers meant. A very naive approach, but one that's sort of grounded in this desire for authenticity to kind of sort out all the what would otherwise be complications like the right to bear arms or the right to vote or things like that. And then there's, you know, the process of judicial reform that you have to go to understand the context of the Constitution in different times and places down to our own, and that's why the Supreme Court keeps ruling on that document that's hundreds of years old, because our time and place changes, and it's only a very naive person that would think that they could understand what it meant in the beginning time and for all time, and that's,
Well, let me ask you this. Did you have any experiences in your journey through the Yoga Sutras of, I don't know if you actually read many of the different versions, but I wonder if you had any reaction to any one version that, like, hit you on the gut as being... Like, you could feel it. Like, did you have that experience, or were you able to just, like, objectively compare all of them, or were there any that, you know, you had an instinctive reaction to?
Well, there's certainly some that I prefer to others. You're speaking of translations into English. There's certainly some that I prefer over others because they seem, A, to be more accurate, and B, to read better than others.
Right.
As you will note from the first chapter of my book, I juxtapose the translations of Yoga Sutra 1-2, Yoga Chitta Vritti Nirodha, sort of the most famous verse in the whole work, and I juxtapose 23 translations of those four words in Sanskrit, and you get a quite amazing variety of possible readings, some by scholars, some by gurus, some by people in between. So I particularly like Barbara Stoller Miller's translation of the Yoga Sutras because it's so beautiful, the English, and I very much like Swami Harihara Ananda Aranya's translation, which is actually a translation into the Bengali, which has subsequently been translated into the English with his own commentary.
With that in mind, that gives people some pointers of things to check out. Let's sort of dive into the murk and give some sense of. And it's a very complex story you tell. There's many layers. There's many ambiguities. But to try to give us some general sense of the philosophical context, the practice context. What sort of general picture can you get of Patanjali, or at the very least, of the people who first attempted to comment and construct a sort of worldview out of these obscure early writings?
It's very hard even to find a place to start. the Yoga Sutra is a philosophical work, and is representative of one of the six quote-unquote classical Hindu philosophical schools, yoga and Samkhya paired together, Vedanta and Mimamsa paired together, and Nyaya and Vaisheshika paired together, for a total of six. And each of those schools attempted to present a theory of everything. That is to say, a metaphysics that explained the individual, the universe, karma, causation, supernatural powers, or what we would call supernatural powers today. It all had to fit. There could not be inconsistencies. It was not a guide, the Yoga Sutras, any more than the other five schools. Core texts were not guides to practice so much as guides to, they were theories of everything, like those of modern-day astrophysics, you know, quantum theory and the fourth fields theories and so forth. They were attempts to explain everything with a single overarching system in which there were no internal contradictions. Now, yoga paired with Samkhya, these were two very early schools. They were fundamentally dualist in their metaphysics, in the sense that there was a radical split difference between spirit and matter, and never the twain should meet.
And talk a little bit more about Samkhya, and I ask that partly just personally, is that when I first started to read about this school, which, you know, in some ways doesn't, you know, kind of dies off, at least explicitly in the evolution of Hindu thinking, even though it you know, informs a lot of different things. There's something about it that seems very striking to me, a kind of blend of this radical dualism with a sort of, you know, it's less religious than it might seem, because we think of you know, we tend to, in the West, think of Hindu philosophy as being mystical, metaphysical, resulting in some ultimate ground where we're in a Vedantic context, where our individual souls or Atmans are identified with the Brahman, with the great mind. And you see there's an element of that happens in Samkhya in terms of their encouragement to remove identifications with matter and to sort of seek some the spark within, and yet it doesn't really go in that larger direction. So I'm really fascinated by that school, and it still seems significant to me, at least personally. So I'd love to have you give us a little more sense of what the dynamics are and the interest of the Samkhya school in terms of understanding the larger flow of Hindu thought.
It's pretty hard to get your head around a lot of Samkhya. So start with the last part of your comment there, the larger flow of Hindu thought. The categories of Samkhya, the 25 tattvas, they are omnipresent in Indian thought. They include the five senses, the five elements, nature, ego, intellect, mind, and so forth. And those you find everywhere. That is the great legacy of Samkhya. Samkhya was the term means something like enumeration, counting, because you basically work in an analytical way through the categories of being in order to realize in an intellectual way that spirit, what you call the spark in all of us, is utterly divorced and isolated from matter. And matter includes not only the body, but also the mind, which is what's really tricky about, for me at least, to understand about Samkhya. And the effort of Samkhya is to realize in this analytical way that the self, the spirit, the Purusha, has nothing to do with matter, Prakriti, and all its devolutes, which include the body and the world and the objects in the world. Yoga piggybacks on that, basically takes Samkhya metaphysics as a given, but suggests that through meditation, one can have a kind of immediate insight into that divorce, that isolation of spirit from matter. And as with every philosophical school, whether theistical, which they all are with the probable exception of Samkhya, the goal of all practice, all philosophy, is the liberation, the release from suffering existence, moksha. And moksha is realized through Samkhya, through analysis, through yoga, via yoga through meditation. And that is what distinguishes yoga from Samkhya. And the Yoga Sutra is one place where you can read that eight-step process, the Ashtanga Yoga of meditation, for realizing that isolation of spirit from matter.
That's one of the things that, of course, people really pick up on, because it seems like, here's like a method, here's a procedure, and when one is introduced to the Yoga Sutras in the context of modern postural yoga class, where they're talking about, they say the eight limbs, and they'll quote them, and it seems to give this sense of a path. Now, of course, there's other models, methods, paths that are emerging in Hinduism at this time. What distinguishes, like in its earlier context, what is interesting about that eight-limb path in relationship to other systems of meditation or other systems of practice that seem to be going on, you know, in roughly around that period of time?
Well, I think I'm going to sort of tweak your question, because what's important here is context. You have mentions of the eight-limb path in many other places than the Yoga Sutras. And this is where I think 20th and 21st century popular understandings of the Ashtanga Yoga are inexact. Because you find this term Ashtanga Yoga, or the eight parts of yoga, in different Sanskrit formulations in the Mahabharata, which is a text that's from the same period as the Yoga Sutras, in one place in the Mahabharata. In Buddhism, the Noble Eightfold Path is analogous in many respects to the Ashtanga Yoga. And then in those Hindu encyclopedias of practice and devotion called the Puranas, that date from about the time of the Yoga Sutras, that is to say 3rd century CE to much later, you also have mentions of the Ashtanga Yoga. But in all of those contexts, the Ashtanga Yoga, the eight-part practice, is framed in a narrative of union between the individual soul and the universal soul. And that is a non-dualist system, which is much closer to Vedanta than to Samkhya. So what I'm saying here is that the Eightfold Practice, Ashtanga Yoga, that virtually all yoga gurus have seized upon since Vivekananda, is one that comes out of the Puranas much more likely than out of the Yoga Sutras themselves. And this is where the sort of canonization of the Yoga Sutras as the source of this set of practices is misguided.
Yeah, I want to underscore this, because it's really a big deal, and it's and I remember when I encountered this problem about the dualism and the non-dualism, and I was like, oh my God, this is like, you know, it's not simply a matter of, you know, somewhat different interpretations, somewhat different cosmologies, even something as radical as the difference between Protestantism and Catholicism in terms of the, you know, different worldviews that are clearly coming from the same stream or set of texts. You know, the difference between a non-dualist view in terms of what the world is, what our role is as, you know, spiritual practitioners or philosophers, and a dualist view is extraordinary. And that's, I think, what the irony really is that you go into this, you're getting a version as a modern person of the Yoga Sutras as this non-dual view, where in the end there's this kind of unity, and that fits in with all sorts of modern notions from the, you know, the hippies to the New Agers to the perennialist metaphysicians who love this non-dual neo-Vedantic approach, like Christopher Isherwood did in the middle of the last century. And then you peel off these layers and you go, wait, no. The Samkhya model is like, get out! You're not this.
Absolutely,
thou art not that.
Can't do this here.
You know, and it's a remarkable transformation, and that's really, to my mind, reading your book was the big picture. Was like, how did this come? How did such a radically different vision come to happen, and why?
Yeah, and I mean the short answer is it was gradually repackaged And it was through the commentator, at least the commentators give us kind of a record of how it was repackaged in a Vedanta envelope, because non-dual Vedanta became the only game in town from the 12th century onwards. It just gained momentum, and it swallowed up all the other systems, with the exception of Nyaya, logic, which remained a subject of instruction in Brahmanic colleges, because you needed it to be able to debate and basically, you know how to construct an argument. But everything else, the other systems, and you read this in all the records from, you know, the 14th century onwards, including down through the 19th century and 20th and 21st, that people could not, that is to say, traditional Indian scholarship no longer had any interest in a dualist system, because the union of individual soul with universal soul, Atman with Brahman, or any devotee with a god identified as Brahman, be he or she named Krishna, Shiva, the great goddess, that was the royal path to liberation. So yoga became subsumed under the broader heading of non-dualist Vedanta, and perhaps unknowingly, this is where the commentators went. The great sort of example of that is Vijnana Bhikshu, 16th century commentator, who was openly a Vedanta, not a non-dual, entirely Vedantaist, but a qualified non-dual Vedantaist. And he basically said the Samkhya system is a relic. There is of no importance to us in our time and place, and non-dual Vedanta is the only way to understand the relationship between man and God and the universe. And so he reads against the grain of the Yoga Sutras in his two commentaries on that text. And his were the last two really great commentaries on the text. In a way, they were the last nails in the coffin of a Samkhya dualist reading of the Yoga Sutras.
It's fascinating how much that transformation can occur. Well, we're going to take a break here. You're listening to Expanding Mind with Eric Davis and Maja Dau. We're talking with Professor David Gordon White about the Yoga Sutra of Patanjali, and we'll be right back.
Welcome back to Expanding Mind on the Progressive Radio Network. This is Maja Dau here with Eric Davis, and we are speaking with Professor David Gordon White today about the Yoga Sutras of Patanjali. And before the break, we were speaking a little bit about this difference between the dualistic and non-dualistic, and how it seems like the earlier ones were dualistic and then it kind of shifted and changed. So keeping along those lines of looking at, like, that's a pretty significant transition, as Eric pointed out, do you feel like as you tracked the information back and got into some of those earlier places before some of those more modern commentaries, do you feel like you kind of came to a satisfactory place with, like, feeling like who Patanjali was as an individual and what were his influences into that? And did you feel like you kind of were able to identify it, or was it just too squirrely to even kind of get a kind of pinpointed answer to?
Well, yeah, as the last chapter of the book indicates, the scholarship on who Patanjali was and what his relationship was to his earliest commentator known as Vyasa, and what his sources were, is still hotly contested by scholars, the same scholars who go back to those commentaries and so forth, to the extent that there are at least two major schools that say Patanjali. One says Patanjali and Vyasa were the same person. They both lived around 425, or that is to say that person lived around 325 CE. And the other and most powerful, to my mind, argument says that Patanjali was perhaps a Buddhist who lived around the first century, and Vyasa was a Hindu who totally subverted the Buddhistic emphasis of the Yoga Sutras, put a Samkhya gloss on them for Hindus against Buddhists in about the 7th century, 8 centuries later than
independent. Because it seems like that would answer the question, right? You could find out, well, was it Samkhya or was it the other one by simply answering the question of, right, like what the sources were for it, seems like, logically.
Seems like sort of the crux of the problem is the language itself of the Yoga Sutras. The Sanskrit is not classical Sanskrit. You can't really read a lot of the terms in the Yoga Sutras using the classical Sanskrit dictionaries or the classical. Yeah,
right.
The text
right.
only has 4 verbs in it. You know, it's 195 sutras, a total of 4 verbs. So you just have a bunch of words, and a lot of the words are what are in what is termed Buddhist hybrid Sanskrit, or closer
yeah.
to that. So that's an argument for a perhaps Buddhistic origin. And Patanjali, there's fairly general agreement that he didn't write the sutras so much as compile them from
right.
different sources, which also, and that the Yoga Sutras as we know them today may be different. It may be that the 4th of the 4 books of the Yoga Sutras was a late add-on, perhaps by a later figure named Vyasa, or perhaps by someone else. So it's
and did
very
you, can I ask
fluid.
You also if you did you find any supernatural or supposed or claimed supernatural origins of the sutras in any of the material you came across, like any snake people or weird stuff like that?
That's mainly the Krishnamacharya Iyengar sort of mythology, where they fuse together local temple myths from South India of a figure named Patanjali or Patanjali, who had no link in the early sources, I'm talking about around 1000 AD, to the Yoga Sutras, but over time he gets morphed into the author of the Yoga Sutras by the 17th or 18th century. But no, Yoga Sutras make no claim to be divine revelation or coming from a god. They're philosophical texts. They're not Shruti. They're not revelation like the Vedas or the Upanishads. They're texts constructed by a human. So that argument that we hear from the Krishnamacharyans is it's a very modern one.
So it's in a way that's another radical transformation, like the shift from
yeah.
dualism to non-dualism is the shift from a mm-hmm. text that, and I think that's also really, I think it really, to my mind anyway, it clarifies the text to think that this might have originally been written by a Buddhist, not only because mm-hmm. some of the ideas I can see sort of working in that zone, but it allows me to read the text more like I look at the early discourses of the Buddha, which have a very, you know, non-supernaturalist, grounded, philosophical, almost dry character, almost intentionally, or, you know, clearly intentionally
yeah.
in some ways,
yeah.
that reflects a real world view. And so once again, we have this kind of text, and then it transforms into a text with a supernatural origin, with a sort of mythopoetic dimension to it, in some ways going again like 180 degrees against the grain. So I mean, you have an amazing story here of like how religions work, or like how things
That's
change,
right.
you know. And it's a really mm-hmm. interesting thing. And I mean, I wanted to ask you about this, is partly as you, in a way, it's almost a question about how you consider your role. I mean, beyond a scholar. I mean, you're within the academia. You're a critical scholar. You're working with these texts. You're doing, there's lots of fine-tuned work that, you know, your colleagues are going to appreciate. You're working hard and understanding the historical development and all the ambiguities, all the complexities, all the shifts, et cetera, et cetera. But you're also writing books that people who are outside of the academy read, people who are interested in yoga, who have that intellectual bent, or are interested in the historical sources. Like I know someone who's a very heterodox Kali fan. I won't quite say worshiper, although there's a magical dimension to his experience. And he has all your books, and he's read them very thoroughly, and he really appreciates the scholarship. So there's a way in which your ideas are going out there in a different fashion. And so when you look at how religions change, how if you have a historical eye, a critical eye, in a way all you see is just new frames, new stories, distortions, inventions. You know, it's just this kind of crazy flow of development with no essence. How do you kind of see, like, your role in introducing that worldview or sort of putting it out there in a zone where people who are also practitioners, people who are also seekers, are reading your work?
A couple of things. One is Nicholas Kristof in the New York Times sometime in the last year wrote an article that professors are going to become increasingly irrelevant if they don't get out of their ivory towers and if they continue to insist on writing books that are only decipherable by people who have, you know, extensive training in the jargon of the discipline that they're in. And and of course, that's not good for higher education, at least humanities education. So I think it's important. I don't see myself as a public intellectual. I don't pronounce on the great issues of the day, although perhaps yoga is. But I do see myself as someone who is trying to straddle the gown in the town, the university, and the broader world. And I do make an effort to make my writing, you know, accessible to a broader readership than simply the 100 or so colleagues that are specializing in yoga studies and so forth. And then the other part of the question, one of the great theoreticians of my field, which is history of religions, Jonathan Z. Smith, he said our role is not to simplify, it's to explain complexity. Complexity is never simple. So you have to be able to find a way to narrativize, to write a story, that's what history writing is, that is as plausible as possible, but also that accounts for complexity, which includes in what appear to be internal contradictions. And to my sort of basic guide, at least that I've set for myself, is to narrativize those differences, to weave them into a story that is engaging but also accurate. And of course, you can't. There is no final word. I mean, what we are doing is we're having a conversation with the past. The next author is going to have a conversation with the past that will include my book, perhaps reject some of what I think and say and accept other aspects of it. And so it goes. That's tradition in both a philosophical and a general sense. So I'm telling a story. I'm trying to tell a good story that's engaging, but also a story that's accurate.
Yeah, and it is a wonderful tale, and to my mind now, you know, I hadn't thought that much about the Yoga Sutra before reading your book. I'd read, you know, a couple versions, and you know, noticed its role within the modern yoga world, which intrigued me. To my mind, it's actually one of the more interesting stories in terms of seeing how important religious texts are invented as much by the later readers and the later commentators, the later repackagers, as the people who wrote it or the original context of it. I mean, it's really quite a remarkable story. And there's a bunch of points of it we haven't really talked to, but I wanted to give you a chance to say a little bit more about Vivekananda, who really seems to be the single most important person in terms of creating a different view of the Yoga Sutras, and also really creating a lot of what we think of as Hindu ideas in the modern West. And what an amazing figure, a revolutionary, very intriguing man. So I'd love to hear you, you know, not just say what he did, but also just give a little sense of what was working in him. What is unusual or singular about him as an intellectual, as someone who was also straddling not the town and the gown, but east and west in a very interesting and revolutionary way in a lot of ways.
Yeah, he was a very artful and powerful culture broker. That was one of the many hats that he wore, explaining Eastern thought to the West, but using, sometimes unbeknownst to himself, Western theories and constructs to frame or even explain to himself those Eastern ideas. He was trained in Western schools in Calcutta, in that great intellectual bastion of colonial India. He knew Hegel better than he knew Hinduism, and it was with that he was first engaged in reform movements in India, and then was attracted to the great mystic Ramakrishna, who lived in a cremation ground in the outskirts of Calcutta. And he spent some time with him, and so he sort of fused this Western intellectual training with the mystical teachings of very charismatic Ramakrishna into his own sort of synthesis. And then because he wanted to reform Hinduism, to get it away from it, what he saw is kitchen rituals, its superstitious excesses that he felt were a departure from the original rational scientific teachings of the Vedas and so forth. He needed funding, and he traveled to the United States and made an incredible splash at the World Parliament of Religions at Chicago in 1894, immediately became a media sensation, and was invited into the great salons of the American intellectual scene, as well as into all the sort of new age of the time context, which were sometimes the same salon. So he knew people like Sarah Bernhardt and Nikolai Tesla and Henry James and his brother William James. So he hobnobbed with scholars from Harvard, but also spiritualists, and spiritualism was a great movement in that time that included theories of mesmerism and animal magnetism and theosophy, which was a great influence on Vivekananda. A lot of the way he read the Yoga Sutras was through the lens of theosophy. So all of that, well, to get back to my point, so he was in the United States to raise money to further his reform efforts back in India. He formed the Ramakrishna Mission in India and the Vedanta Society in the U.S. and the West, actually in New York, I believe it was. And those were sort of the two beachheads that he saw as being the places to pivot off of, to raise Hinduism back to its original glorious past, but also to introduce the Western world to the glories of Hinduism, which he felt was being misrepresented by the colonial powers, the British and so forth. So that those were all parts of the same project for him.
Well,
apparently he worked so hard
this.
that he... Sorry, go ahead.
Oh, well, it's just so fascinating because he kind of was like... Were there other Indian missionaries kind of like bringing yoga to the West before him? Like, do you feel like he was the one that made it and became popular, or were there other figures that you would kind of compare? He was kind of like the, because it's funny for how many Christian missionaries go out everywhere, right? Where there's just like one guy bringing yoga over here. It's weird.
Yeah, I believe he was the first. There were others that followed in his path, of course, but not that many. There were a handful of them in the decades following his brief time here, because he died very suddenly, just a couple few years after he came to the West. And after he wrote his book called The Raja Yoga, which was his quote-unquote translation and commentary into English on the Yoga Sutras, there were two things. One was those that followed him from India, they didn't talk about the Yoga Sutras. They promoted yoga as kind of a alternative healing path. Some sounds very familiar in our modern context. There was the xenophobic American immigration policies that came into effect in the early 20s. That basically barred all Asians from coming into the United States virtually, and so that was it. There were no yoga gurus of any sort that could come to the States basically until the 60s,
wow.
Just in time for the cultural awakening that we all know of here. So he was sort of the alpha and until the 60s the omega of yoga sutra commentary, Indian gurus teaching yoga sutras in the West, apart from some who were in Europe where the immigration policies were different, particularly in the British Commonwealth, where, of course, India was part of. So there were yoga gurus in places like England and Ireland, and that's why William Butler Yeats, the great Irish poet, co-authored a translation of the Yoga Sutras with an Indian guru, Sri Purohit Swami, in the 19-teens, I believe it was.
So to get back to the Yoga Sutra story, why at this point, late 19th century, there's a new mix, there's new frames of Hinduism that are emerging with Vivekananda and others. Part of it has a political purpose, part of it has a nationalist purpose, part of it is about blending or finding a balance between Western philosophy and psychology and an idea of yoga tradition or of Hindu tradition. Why did Vivekananda turned to the Yoga Sutras if by that point it was a relatively obscure text of a philosophical position that had died long ago and was not one of the, you know, was nothing like the Bhagavad Gita in terms of being a popular object of devotion? What was it about that text that was important for him and his agenda?
Well, a couple things. He'd been exposed to it by one of his teachers in India, and so he knew of it, which was already quite important, but also he saw it as a non-sectarian text because it didn't belong to any particular religious tradition. So it didn't carry the trappings of Hinduism with its quote unquote superstitions. It wasn't specifically Buddhist or Jain or Sikh or Muslim. It was just this philosophical text which he felt and that he could present as a kind of pure example of Indian scientific thought, of Indian rational thought. The Bhagavad Gita would have been too Hindu. Other of the yoga texts that were around, same thing. So that was his principal reason probably for choosing the Yoga Sutras over other works. Also, he was probably influenced by the Theosophists, who were the first non-scholarly group to quote-unquote discover the Yoga Sutras. And there are historical reasons for seeing how Vivekananda would have taken some of his leads from the Theosophists. And there was this kind of odd blend between scientism, that is to say, sort of pseudoscience, like animal magnetism, and spiritualism, which, you know, grew out of seances and the like, and ectoplasmic apparitions. And so that was kind of the spirituality, the scientific spirituality of the West, that he was influenced by and that he saw as kind of, well, that was his main audience in the West. So these are the people he was talking to, and he felt he could speak their language by translating the Yoga Sutras into a scientistic, spiritualistic version, which is what he does.
Right. Well, we only have a few minutes here, and I realize that we didn't really go into the Eightfold Path, which is really the part of the thing, or the eight-limbed path that most people kind of encounter. We haven't talked about Krishnacharya very much. It's a very long and rich story. But I'm just kind of curious, just to wrap it up with a couple minutes, what you would hope would shift or would happen to people who are already familiar with the text coming away from your story. What's like the vision of the text that you would love to see, propagated or spread into the world?
I guess my first response would be, don't worry if it's hard for you to understand, because it's inherently very difficult text. I mean, it's a compilation of no fewer than two and perhaps as many as six different sort of strands of tradition that were compiled perhaps by a figure named Patanjali somewhere between 2,000 and 1,600 years ago. And it in spite of the fact that every philosophical system strove to be totally coherent without any internal contradictions, this one is kind of a pastiche. And even the greatest scholars of yoga, the critical scholars, they have a very difficult time resolving it into a coherent whole. So nor should we be terribly troubled if we can't get our heads around everything that's in it. Is it a guide for practice? I don't think so. I really don't see that it should have the importance that it does in the modern yoga subculture. I say it in the first paragraph of the book. It's as relevant to modern practice as understanding the workings of a combustion engine is to driving a car. Just drive that car. It seems to me that there's a kind of a fixation on this text that's actually harmful, in the sense that people feel themselves to be somehow inadequate if they don't, you know, understand this philosophical ground for their practice. It's not the philosophical ground for their practice. It's a philosophical system that is very old and was lost for several hundred years due to disinterest. My message is don't get too hung up on Yoga Sutras.
That's great. That's a great place to end. Hey, Professor Y, thank you so much for joining us, Expanding Mind. It was another great talk.
Thanks for having me.
All right, for me and Majid Ali out there, keep your minds open.